Well, it's a blessing this morning to direct your attention to the book of Esther. And last week I had mentioned that we were starting a new expositional series in this book of Scripture. And this beautiful account of some amazing and unexpected works of God. Our last series, of course, was in the Gospel of Luke, and usually I try to vary our main preaching series between Old and New Testament, and so the Lord has directed my attention to this portion of His Word in the book of Esther. If you remember way back, some of you can remember this, when we did a study in the book of Genesis and considered that this kind of literature, this Old Testament narrative style that God chose to communicate so much of His Word, it is different from maybe what we're used to reading in the New Testament. It is not as direct, it is not as explicit about the theological point that God is getting at or the application for our lives. And you really have to have the mindset of a detective. Because the Lord in all these narrative books has woven together plenty of clues that as we trace them along, as we piece them together, we really can come to a solid understanding of the message and its relevance to our lives. You would be able to say something about that even from your own general reading of literature. If you like a good novel or a good short story, you know what it's like to get pulled into something that very gradually unfolds and you don't understand at the beginning who all these people are or where these places are or how this all fits together. And there really is something delightful about a well-told, a well-crafted story that pulls you in that way and that makes an impact in a unique way that is sometimes more powerful than just somebody saying, this is how it is, and this is what you must do. It has the power to touch your heart and to draw out not just your mind, but your emotions and your imagination. And this is how the Lord chose to inspire the book that we're looking at. But because of the different sort of form, I usually approach it in a different sort of way. We don't tend to preach or expound narrative books in quite the same way as we would something like an epistle. And I am planning, as possible, to use PowerPoint, which I am taking by faith is behind me, and I'm not going to worry about it. If something gets messed up, don't let it bother you. Just listen, and if you really want the notes, I'll be happy to send you the PowerPoint later. But hopefully this will be a way to help us track what the Lord is telling us through this particular book. You may have read a little news item that came out about a week ago, and I'll read to you a little bit of it. It says, a police chase in Oregon came to an abrupt halt when a male driver fleeing local authorities in a stolen car crashed into a woman who was driving another vehicle. And it goes on to give the details of a fellow named Randy, who stole a Toyota Land Cruiser. And for several blocks, he was fleeing before he collided with a Buick Regal while he was attempting to elude law enforcement. Randy was arrested, charged with unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, attempting to elude the police, assault, and reckless driving. After taking him into custody, the police discovered that the second vehicle had also been reported stolen 3 weeks prior. And so the driver of that vehicle, Kristen, was also arrested and got into trouble herself. Who would have thought? Here this man was doing something, the other lady thinking she was getting away with it, and in a quote-unquote random series of events, they both end up nabbed for stealing vehicles. Life is that way sometimes, where random events as you look back, your hindsight reveals that there was more going on than you would have been aware of at the time. And as a believer, you're able to see the interweaving both of good things and bad things in your life. Don't always understand, but often you can see, as it were, the fingerprints of God, and have some sense of how along the way, through at the time seemingly random events, the Lord was working step by step, little by little, to accomplish his purposes for you. And this is a message that we are always in need of. But I think one of the reasons my thoughts went to this particular book is because we are living through a day where there seems to be a lot of random and wild things going on that do not seem to be following any particular plan, that all seem negative, and that we have a hard time understanding how God could still be in charge and pursuing our good and his redemption when so many things seem to be out of control. Whether you think about something like the coronavirus and the havoc that it has wreaked in the world and people's health and even people's lives and the economies of world powers, whether you think about all the social unrest in our country, and the fact that we are in an election year as well, and the whole country is focused on who will be our next president, and all of the confusing messages that regularly come out of our political authorities, and the uncertainty of figuring out what in the world people really are after, and how this is all supposed to be following some kind of a reasonable plan for governing our nation. And where is this all going to end? And then the fact that as a part of that upheaval, those who are approaching life from a secular worldview are so intent on pushing their godless agendas and marginalizing Christians, we find ourselves struggling to know kind of where we fit in this country anymore, and what to make of all of this, and how to respond, and how to live as the people of God in a culture that is, in many ways, going in the opposite direction of what the scriptures would teach. I think a book like Esther is very suited, not to answer our specific questions about those kinds of things, not to tell us exactly what we're supposed to do about them tomorrow morning, but it is here to give us the perspective that we need. It's here to give us a lens, a theological, a God-centered lens through which we ought to be viewing these things that on our level seem to make no sense and seem to be so random and out of control, and look at things from the Lord's perspective. And here we have a book that gives us a powerful tool revealing that the unseen hand of God is always at work to pursue the objectives that God has determined. And as you see there, one way that we can title the book of Esther as a whole is Seeing the Unseen Hand of God. Most of the time, God's hand is invisible to us. But sometimes, particularly in the records of the scriptures, we find that the Lord pulls back the curtain and gives us a glimpse into the kinds of things that he is up to, the kinds of things going on behind the scenes, the kinds of things that people involved on their level at the time, doing the best they can under their circumstances, have no idea where this is all going. And yet, consistently, the Lord is using all those events and weaving all these things together to accomplish what he has determined. Esther will help us see something of the hand of God that normally is unseen in the day-to-day struggles and circumstances and problems that we face. This morning, I'd just like to introduce us to this book. We're going to dip into a few verses here and there, but we'll start into the chapters one by one until we come back next week, Lord willing. And I want to begin by asking the when question. When did these things take place? And what is the historical background against which these events happened as we come here to the last few hundred years of history that the Old Testament records? And I don't want this to be too academic, but there are, I think, some basic pieces of information that we want to have in our minds to give us the right understanding of when these things took place and how the history relates to what we're finding here. This is actually not the only book in Scripture or the only events that we are told about from this, what we call post-exilic period of the people of Israel. And I just want to highlight for us a few key dates that hopefully will get us up to speed here to understand where Esther is coming from. The first date is the year 538 BC, or maybe 539. When you go back this far, there's always a little wiggle room for a year here and there. But this is a huge date in the history of God's people. Because after they had been those 70 years in the country of Babylon, the tribe of Judah specifically, suffering the judgment of God in exile for all of their heaped up idolatries, a new ruler comes on the scene. And he, Cyrus II, or Cyrus the Great, king of Persia, topples the nation of Babylon and effectively becomes the ruler of the then known world, the Persian Empire, as we call it. And he takes a different tack toward these peoples that were exiled. We know as a politician that his motives were mixed. It wasn't that he believed in Yahweh. It wasn't that he cared that much about the people of God and being in their homeland and worshiping their temple. This was a way, best we can tell, of him just furthering his power and ingratiating himself to these people, not just the Jews, others as well, that were under his authority, and he sends them back. We read those stories of them going back and rebuilding as though it were a great revival. And in some ways, it was a national revival. But we want to understand that the people of Judah were still a colony of Persia. They were still very much under the whims of the emperors who could be influenced against them at any time. And even though they did eventually rebuild, there was all kinds of drama that they had to suffer through, persecution, obstacles, discouragements, in order to get that work accomplished. It wasn't really that these rulers personally were supportive of them. It was actually the hand of God orchestrating politics in order to advance his purposes for his people. And it's amazing when you read these stories of the amount of money that the Persian government on more than one occasion sent to fund the rebuilding of the place of the worship of God. And you read books like Ezra and Nehemiah, and it keeps talking about the hand of the Lord was upon us. And God was doing these remarkable things to where after not too many years, and now we come to the next year, 516, after a few decades, challenging as they were at times, the people of God were able to rebuild the temple. And Cyrus began the process in 538 by decreeing that they could return to their homeland, by funding their work of restoration. And in 516, the temple is established, the worship of God is renewed, sacrifices being offered, priests being leading in the worship. And it would seem that Israel was as restored as they could be under those kinds of circumstances. Well, we read on in history and we come to the next day to the man that is the Persian emperor at the time of the book of Esther. We know him in our Bibles by the name Ahasuerus. According to the Greeks, his name, he went by Xerxes. It's really the same individual. And he reigns for a period when there was growing tension between the Persians and another power developing further west that would eventually come to be known as the Greek Empire of Alexander the Great. And I stop there to make this point again about the people of God, that even those who were restored and enjoying the homeland were still a colony, and after this period of being a colony of the Persians, they became a colony of the Greeks, and later a colony of the Romans, and then it was all torn down, that temple, in AD 70, after the death and resurrection of Christ. But at this point, things are going relatively well over there in Palestine. In fact, as other challenges are faced, the Lord raises up a generation of leaders to help, to encourage, to minister to his people. And the next date would be the 450s, the 430s, the ministries of Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra is a teacher of the law that is commissioned by the emperor to go and actually help the people on a spiritual level. Nehemiah, his ministry is not so much about the temple building, but about the reparation of the walls in order to fortify the city of Jerusalem against its enemies. And so right in the middle of those kinds of events that we know from Ezra and Nehemiah especially, during this period, the 480s to 460s, is when Ahasuerus is the king, and into his reign, after a certain period, there are actually indications of specific years, and Esther is chosen as queen. So there's a lot going on for God's people. But most of what we know was going on about them and for them was over there back in Palestine. The focus on the temple, the focus on rebuilding. And yet there were people, thousands of them, believers, some of them, of Jewish lineage, descendants of those who went in exile, that actually, for whatever reason, chose to stay back in Persia and those other cities under that empire. And to help us appreciate the significance of that, the next slide is going to remind us of what are the books of the Bible that we're talking about. I mentioned Ezra and Nehemiah, but there's actually several others that date to around this same period. You have the book of Chronicles, which is a huge, long retelling of the history of God's people, really going all the way back to Adam with the genealogies and going all the way to the decree of Cyrus that they should go back. And that book was written to encourage the people that had returned to stay committed to the temple, to stay committed to the pure worship of God. In fact, it might have been written by Ezra. And Ezra's story is told in the book that bears his name, his ministry of teaching and renewal. And then you have Nehemiah with the walls. It's in this list that you have the book of Esther, but that's not the end of it either. You have three books of the prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, who had a huge part in the process of rebuilding the temple with their preaching, encouraging the people. And then a little bit later period, you have Malachi who comes along to actually correct some of the problems that had been developing through the years after the exile with the corruption and the heartlessness of the worship of God. In other words, most of these books have to do with what's going on over there, the challenges they face, the discouragements, and even the sins that they're committing, their spiritual decline after a while. And it would seem that the Lord's attention is over there in the Holy Land. The book of Esther is the only one that tells you anything substantial about what's going on with the people of God back in Persia. Those, again, that for whatever reason chose not to return, and who could have been easily tempted to think, we don't fit into the plan of God. We haven't gone back. We're surrounded by pagans. We are foreigners in this land. We have no contribution to make to the purposes of God. Even though Persia and these cities, the capital and so forth, they're like the center of the world empires, their understanding would be Jerusalem was actually the center of the purposes of God. And we're over here in the backwaters as a persecuted minority, and we have no thing to contribute to the purposes of God. Does God even notice us? Does God even care? Are we even a part of his plan? The big thing going on in the world from a theological perspective is Jerusalem. We're over here. Where do we fit in? Have we been abandoned? Are we going to receive ourselves any of the blessings of being the covenant people of God? Are we going to be overrun by the majority population here that is so godless? Is there any hope for us to enter into the blessing of God, feel like we're a part of what God is doing in the world? That is the context in which people like Mordecai and people like Esther would have been living, separate from all of the restoration that's going on in the Holy Land. Keep that in mind, and we want to talk, number two, and primarily this morning, about the outline, the structure, or the how. That is, how this story develops. I've talked about the when, now this is the how. And even if you read Esther in a very cursory way, you would go away with the impression that the author is a genius in the way that he has brought all this together. That you are reading a literary masterpiece. And in fact, as we analyze it, using forms that we are used to from short stories and novels, it follows perfectly the plot line that you would expect of a good story. And I want to show it to you in a graphic here. I've used this sort of graphic before to talk about the structure of certain Bible stories or Bible books. But it follows six different steps, we might say, as this plot unfolds. There's first, for a couple of chapters, what technically is called the exposition of the story, and that's just a word that means the introduction, where the setting is being put out there, the characters are being introduced, you have some idea of where these things take place and the environment in which this happens, but really the main action of the story has not begun. This is all by way of introduction. And it's actually a pretty long introduction, two whole chapters. And these different movements or acts in the story, they divide up according to individual scenes. And so what are the scenes at this point? You find in chapter 1 that King Xerxes throws a lavish feast. And it's this enormous and expensive display of his power and his authority and his glory. But everything comes crashing down when his wife refuses to come and display her beauty to those who were in attendance. And so following the advice of his counselors, he deposes her. He publishes an edict about the situation to guarantee that the men of his kingdom would still be in charge of their homes. He showed her. And that's the end of chapter 1. Chapter 2, after a while, he gets lonely, though he was surrounded by women. But he wants a new queen, and so he devises this beauty contest to select who his next wife is going to be. And surprisingly, it ends up being a beautiful Jewess by the name of Esther, and that's chapter 2, most of it. But at the end of chapter 2, the final scene here, we read that Esther's cousin, who helped her get into the position of queen, Mordecai is his name, he uncovers an assassination plot against the king, and he saves the man's life. But he is not immediately rewarded. What happens is that that action of Mordecai's is written down in the royal records of Xerxes, but we're not really told what came of it. And it seems like happened with Joseph so many years ago. The good and noble and even courageous things that were done got forgotten by people in authority who had the power to recognize, to honor, to reward. And that's just kind of left hanging. And that's the end of this introduction. What happens next is actually the beginning of the story proper, or what we call the inciting moment. It's the first six verses of chapter 3. And you're introduced to another situation that would seem to have nothing to do with what you've read so far. It has to do with a pagan man by the name of Haman, who is elevated above all the other nobles of the land, and who goes around flaunting his position and requiring people to bow before him and honor him. And yet this man Mordecai refuses to bow the knee. And so in retaliation, Haman determines that he's going to use his power to kill not only Mordecai, but all the Jews he could lay his hands on. And that decision of Haman, his intent to destroy the people of God, who are already a neglected, a marginalized minority, a looked down on people, that decision of Haman to annihilate them is what gets this story going. And the action unfolds after that in several other scenes. And as chapter 3 goes on, Haman convinces Xerxes to decree that all the Jews would be killed on an appointed day that he chooses by casting lots or dice. And the king goes along with it. The king puts his own power and his own seal behind that pogrom. Mordecai finds out about this in chapter 4. He grieves for the devastation that is to come. He tells Esther about it and kind of has to argue with her so that she would stick her neck out and risk her own life in order to save the life of her people by intervening with the king and trying to figure out some sort of way to deliver them. Esther does that, and in chapter 5, she is granted an audience with the king. And when he asks her what he wants, she says, "I want to give you and Haman a banquet." And we're going to see a number of banquets and celebrations in this story. Esther begins with a party and it ends with another party. And there are some other parties in between. And the banquet scene is one of the great motifs of the story that keeps it all moving along. So Esther wants to put on a banquet of her own. When it happens, Haman is thinking, "Wow, the queen is honoring me. This is awesome. Now she is giving me respect as well as the king." And when it comes to that banquet and she is asked what she would like, she says, "I want to give a second banquet. Come back tomorrow and I'll give you my request." And so that's what happens as you read on into chapters 5 and 6. But there are some very important things that happen before the second banquet. Haman goes out of that place full of pride, and he runs across Mordecai, who again refuses to bow the knee to him. When he gets home, he gloats with his family and friends over his accomplishments in the court and how the queen has honored him. And the one thing that he's not happy about, the one complaint he has, is about this guy Mordecai. And so his family says, "Look, you have this power. Just find a way to get rid of him as fast as you can." And he decides, with their encouragement, to build an enormous gallows on which he's going to hang Mordecai. And something's going to have to give, or this story is going to come to an end pretty quickly. Something has to turn the action in a different direction. And in terms of literary analysis, we call that the crisis, the turning point of the plot, which happens in chapter 6. And what happens in chapter 6 looks to be a random situation where King Xerxes cannot sleep, and he calls on his officials to have some of the royal records read to him, and they somehow, out of all the things they could have read, come to the part that talked about, you know, a while ago, Mordecai saved your life. And he realizes he never did anything to thank him. And the next thing you read is that Haman comes into the court in order to ask for permission, specifically right away, to hang Mordecai. Before he can get that out of his mouth, the king says, "What do you think I should do if I really wanted to honor somebody?" He said, "Wow, you would put him on your royal beast and have him carted through the town and have everybody bow before him and just have everyone join in this praise that you want to give to this wonderful individual." And the king says, "Great idea. There's a guy named Mordecai that I want to do this for." So Haman is tasked with preparing all of that and with leading the parade of Mordecai on the royal horse through the city. Haman has no choice under those circumstances but to follow along and to honor his enemy. And when that's all over, the man is crushed. He returns home humiliated. And his wife realizes that things have turned against him and that he is doomed to fall before his enemy. And they hardly have time to process that, but the people come to escort him back to the palace for that second banquet. And what I just described there from chapter 6, those different events that took place, that is the turning point. And now things are going to move pretty rapidly to a resolution, particularly with this falling action in chapter 7 and through 9. And what happens at that banquet is that Esther reveals her Jewish identity. She cries out against Haman's plot to kill her people. In pretty short order, Xerxes has Haman hanged on the very gallows that he built for Mordecai. And he turns around and he promotes Mordecai to the position that Haman had enjoyed. And when they're working out a way to deliver the people of Israel, the king empowers Mordecai to issue an edict that they could defend themselves. He didn't find a way to undo the law. He had already stated it in a very firm way that could not be altered, but they came up with a plan B to find a way for them to defend themselves, to fight back, to kill their enemies on the day of that pogrom that had been determined. And the city rejoices there at the end of chapter 8 that deliverance was going to be possible. And then most of chapter 9 is given over to that appointed day and the day after, when the Jews are able to defeat their enemies. In fact, one day was not enough, so they gave them an extra day to fight back. And by the time it's all over, almost 76,000 enemies of the Jewish people had been punished, ultimately by the Lord, through death on that occasion. And then what you have remaining as you come to the end of the book is the denouement, or just the final sort of settling down of the tension. And it is a very joyful ending. In fact, such a remarkable thing had taken place that they decided this was worth announcing a national holiday to celebrate. And they said, "We're going to call it Purim, lots, dice," because that was what Haman had used to determine when he was going to wipe us out. And he was the one that got wiped out. And so they established this annual celebration of Purim to commemorate their deliverance. And the book ends with this glowing description of the greatness of Mordecai as the defender of his people. And that is the plot of the book of Esther. Now, even from what I've said, you can, I think, detect how this is all communicating a message and how the Lord is at work through these events. But I do want to summarize for you the theme that we're going to see as we come back through the individual chapters of that story. And I can put it this way. That against all odds, God providentially accomplishes his purposes for his people. In the case of the Jews, it was a purpose of protection in the immediate. We know that the Lord protected them because he had much grander things for them in the future. But this book tells us about God's sometimes mysterious ways of carrying out everything he has determined for the good of his people. He does it against all human odds. And in the face of what seem to be impossibilities at the outset. I want to flesh that out a little bit, and then when we come back to the chapters, we'll see it in more detail. First of all, the main emphasis is on the marvel of divine providence. The marvel of divine providence is what you walk away with primarily. You say, well, that's kind of an odd theme, because if I know anything about Esther, what stands out is that the name of God is never mentioned. And I had always known that the Jewish people struggled with what was going on in Esther not having the name of God in it, and struggled with whether it belonged in their Bible. But Martin Luther said some pretty nasty things about the book of Esther. He was not happy with this book. And whatever Martin said, he said it dogmatically. And you can look up statements where he was really questioning the validity of this particular story, especially because it did not explicitly talk about God. And yet I'm saying this book is all about God. It's not really about Esther. It's not really about Mordecai. This is about God. How do we see God? Even though his name is not mentioned. Well, I want to point out a few things that we're going to run across. First of all, some implicit divine references. Even though God's name does not occur, there are other ways that the author is giving you his point of view and how he wants you to see God without him actually bringing up the Lord's name. A couple of verses here in chapter 4. If you're in Esther, you can just go ahead to the 4th chapter. And again, these are indirect, but these people were coming from a certain theological background of who God is and his sovereignty and his covenants and his purposes. And it says in chapter 4, verse 14, "For if you keep silent at this time," he's talking to Esther, Mordecai is, "relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place," etc., etc. In other words, this man does not express doubt whether this is all going to work out. It's going to come from somewhere. Of that I am confident. Why? Because he understood that God had made certain promises to his people. And he had committed himself. He had put his own character on the line. And it may be that actually that phrase, "another place," is a way of talking about God, not directly about the people that God would use. And then what about a little later in verse 16? Esther says, "Go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day, and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go and talk to the king." Why do people fast? Because they just don't feel like eating for a few days? They're not hungry anymore? The whole point of fasting is to seek God and to humble yourself And to show the Lord by that extreme self-denial that you really sense your need of him and your dependence on him and God help us and God, that's why they were fasting. That was a statement of faith, and it was a declaration indirectly of the place of God in the center of this story. And there's even some irony in the fact that they chose that word Purim for the feast. Because their Bible and some of the Proverbs written by their great King Solomon in chapter 16, verse 33, there was information about lots elsewhere in their Bible. And that verse says, the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of Yahweh. This is not the first time that they had thought about lots or that they had heard about that being a part of the outworking of the purposes of God. So you have those kinds of implicit divine references. You have as well a whole series of quote-unquote coincidences. And I put them in scare quotes on purposes because they're really not. They just look that way on the surface, like, wow, isn't it really cool? That at the very moment that Haman walks in wanting to go and kill Mordecai, the king comes back before he can say that and says, hey, what am I going to do for the guy that I want to honor? And it's Mordecai. Isn't that interesting? There is no way that all of these things can just happen and be lined up exactly in the order and according to the timing that they are as you read this book. I'm not going to take the time here, but I have a list of about 10 things like that. And we will pick up on them along the way. What human beings call coincidence are interconnected events that are being orchestrated by this unseen hand of God. And then maybe the biggest thing is the idea of reversals and how these things don't just happen at the perfect moment, but these things that happen, many of them are turning things around in the opposite direction from which they had been going. And again, I have a whole list of things here that we're going to see as we go along. But let me highlight what was at the top of that diagram of the plot. I'll read to you a statement here from one of the well-known commentators on Esther. The author uses the word peripety, which means reversal, the turning around of things, and says, by making the pivot point of that peripety an insignificant event rather than the point of highest dramatic tension, the author is taking the focus away from human action. What was that insignificant event? You know what turned the whole thing around, humanly speaking? This guy could not sleep. That's it. Maybe he'd had too much pizza the night before. Maybe he'd had a falling out with Esther. Maybe he was worried about some big decision he had to make. He could not sleep. And we would say, humanly speaking, you know, would the rest of it have happened if this guy didn't have a sleepless night? And you read the story, you're not thinking wonderful things about Xerxes and how compassionate he was and how favorable he was toward the people of God. It's just that he happened, he couldn't sleep that night, and the Lord used that to get this process going in a totally opposite direction. Had the pivot point of the peripety been at the scene where Esther approaches the king uninvited, or where Esther confronts Haman, the king and or Esther would have been spotlighted as the actual cause of the reversal. Esther was involved. Yes, she played a vital role. Yes, I'm going to touch on that in a moment. But the mover and the cause behind all this is God behind the scenes. And by setting up the story that way, this commentator says, it reinforces the message that no one in the story, not even the most powerful person in the empire, is in control of what is about to happen. An unseen power is controlling the reversal of the destiny. And folks, with all that in mind, I would put it to you this way. The genius of this story to get across the message is the very fact that it doesn't mention the name of God. That's like the point. God doesn't have to shout at you. God doesn't have to even use his name to prove himself to you. You just be attentive to his providence at work in ways that have no human explanation. There's where you're going to see God. You don't need him to tell you, you know, footnote, I did this. Right? The Lord is revealing himself to you by the inner workings of the story. But that doesn't mean that people are not responsible. And we are going to see these ideas come out in the story as well. Not just the marvel of divine providence, but the role as well of human responsibility as a secondary theme. And I'll just read these points for you. We'll develop them as we come to them. First of all, human beings cannot ultimately thwart the purposes of God. Not Haman, not anybody. Number two, human beings can choose to contribute to what God is doing, and God in his grace rewards them richly. And Esther does have a book in the Bible that bears her name, and Mordecai does have a feast that he's sort of the hero that's being celebrated. The Lord uses people, and a book like this, as a secondary idea, does urge us to do whatever is in our hands to do that we know would advance what God intends. And the mystery of his providence includes the choices that we voluntarily make to not assist or help him, but to be his instruments of his working. And what about when people mess up, even the people of God? I want to give you this thought as well, that even human sin ends up in this book contributing to the purposes of God. To be honest with you, I have some real questions about the character of Esther and Mordecai. And we'll get to that in those chapters. But for as wrong of whatever it is that they did, God was able to weave all of that even, in putting them into the right place at the right time to do what he intended to do. Now, just a quick word about how this is going to apply to us. In general, I would put it this way, that this book and all these incidents woven together, it encourages renewed confidence in the redemptive plan of God. Specifically, these items I want to emphasize. First of all, and at the heart of the story of the Bible, God's plan for what he intended to do with the Messiah, who was also marginalized and didn't come just to the brink of being annihilated, but actually was killed on a cross by a pagan government and was resurrected. And this book is paving the way, keeping the hope alive, and showing you that when things are the bleakest, even for the Messiah himself, God is a God of reversals and turns things around like you would never have expected. I believe the same applies for the nation of Israel still to this day, that for as strange as events might seem and as opposed as the whole world might be against that one people group, and for as much suffering as they have undergone in history, the Lord still has a plan for them. The Lord has not abandoned them. Everything is going according to his timeline. A book of, like Esther, assures them that God is going to turn things around for them. But it is not just for them, it is for all nations. God is ruling over the most wicked of empires. And he is showing his sovereignty here over all peoples to do everything he intends for the nations of the world. And some he will judge, and some he will have mercy on. But nothing escapes the rule of Yahweh, every nation. And then ultimately, what probably most of us are concerned about the most. This assures us that in the lives of us little people, who feel so small in the world and who feel so helpless and who feel like nobody appreciates our efforts or Even the Lord has sort of put us on the shelf, and not a whole lot is going on in our lives. These were no-name people that God used to accomplish these things. It's not just the things on the big scheme of his plan, but down to the minute detail of the smallest life, insignificant as it may seem, the Lord is providentially working against all odds to accomplish for you individually everything that he in his goodness has determined. This book is for us kind of like the Romans 8:28 of the Old Testament. And we're going to find our hearts strengthened and renewed as we look into it with more detail.